Welcome to a Wednesday evening Clear Mountain live stream. Aja, good to see you.
Good to see you.
Andrew, Professor Burns, we are so grateful for you joining us. Thank you.
It's a delight to be here. Thank you for having me.
Let me do a brief introduction. Andrew Burns is a scholar specializing in medieval and early modern Jewish and intellectual cultural history in the Mediterranean with a focus on Italy and Spain. He earned his PhD from the University of Pennsylvania in 2011. Dr. Burns has held prestigious positions, including the Melville J. Kahn Fellow at Villa I. Tati, the Viterbi Visiting Professor at UCLA, and the Rose and Henry Zifkin Teaching Fellow at the Katz Center for Advanced Judaic Studies. His first book, The Bible and Natural Philosophy in Renaissance Italy, published by Cambridge University Press in 2015, explores the interplay between European medicine and biblical interpretation, winning the 2016 Howard R. Moraro Prize. His 2022 book, The Land is Mine, examines the relationship between Sephardi Jews and land use in Renaissance Iberia through biblical commentaries, reflecting the intellectual concerns of exiled Spanish Jews. And I thought I'd read through that and gotten all the pronunciations, and now I realize I had very much not. So apologies, Dr. Burns. But just as a bit of more context, Professor Andrew Burns and I met several years ago when I was in Winthrop, and we just had these really fascinating conversations or beginnings of conversations around his interest and study of Kabbalah, Jewish mysticism, and magic. And I just felt like often when you're triangulating a truth or a kind of a point, the wider the angle, the more accurate the triangulation. And sometimes I find approaching truth from these other traditions is so meaningful for exactly that reason. So when we heard we would have the chance to talk to Andrew about the traditions he's studied so much, it was a really great opportunity. So thank you so much for joining us tonight.
It's a real pleasure to be here. Ajahn Nisabo and Ajahn Kovilo, thank you so much for having me.
So we'll begin with some questions, and people can type any questions they have in the chat as well. So one thing is, how would you define Kabbalah? And do you think of Kabbalah as eternal or unchanging or affected by historical processes?
There's no warm-up, Ajahn Nisabo. We just go straight to that. The most demanding questions. I would define Kabbalah off the cuff, and by the way, I'll pronounce it as Kabbalah with the stress on the final syllable, but if anyone during the Q&A wants to say Kabbalah, that's totally fine. I won't be offended. It's not inaccurate, so let's be relaxed about it. I would define Kabbalah as an approach to understanding both the sacred scriptures of Judaism and the world itself as containing many layers of meaning, the exoteric or revealed or obvious layer of meaning, and the esoteric or latent, hidden layer of meaning. And the reason why I say both scripture and the world is to cast as wide a net as possible. Kabbalists are, first and foremost, devotees of the Jewish tradition and scholars of it. And there are some who even see it as a science or a form of magic, to use the term you used before, Ajahn Nisabo, meaning a way of approaching the world potentially at a distance to affect change or influence people, animals, plants, even God, him, her, themself. I believe your second question was, when did it originate? And this is a matter of considerable controversy among scholars, the majority of which will probably bore both you two and your audience. So I'll just say that in the traditional devout view, Kabbalah goes all the way back to remote antiquity, even as far as Adam in the Bible, that is to say the first human being, the spouse of Eve. More scientifically minded scholars usually date its emergence to the same century that saw the emergence of Christianity in Roman Palestine, that is to say the first century of the Common Era. Still other people who wish to discredit Kabbalah and impugn its claims to antiquity call it a medieval forgery that only arose in the Middle Ages, specifically in 13th century Spain. So from Adam in the book of Genesis all the way to the High Middle Ages, there's a tremendous range. And as you can tell, the way someone thinks about when and where Kabbalah emerged says a lot about how they understand the tradition and Judaism's claims to primordial revelation.
Thank you. And yeah, you fielded that one quite well, actually, for a cold start. So in terms of looking at this as a spiritual path, what is the goal of Kabbalah practice? And does that goal have any similarities to what you understand of the Buddhist concept of Nibbana, a sort of complete clarity and peace of heart that's unchanging? What is the goal of Kabbalah practice and how is it moved towards?
Well, I'll start at the end and a statement of humility really before I begin. I know very little about Buddhism. And I come to you live from a part of Northern California, Sebastopol in particular, where there are a lot of Buddhist prayer flags flying and a lot of centers for meditation and study. And I feel a lot of curiosity and even more ignorance about it. So I won't pretend to be knowledgeable about this tradition that you two are so devoted to and steeped in. From what you said about the goal of Buddhism, I would go so far as to say that all great world traditions, and I would put yours in that category, and certainly Judaism, and I won't bother listing others for fear that I'll offend someone by leaving other things out, do aim for that kind of clarity of mind or clarity of purpose. And you're making me think, Ajahn Nisipo, about one of the challenges of teaching Kabbalah as I do to a lay audience of mostly non-Jewish students at the University of South Carolina, which is my home institution. And the deeper I go into this subject, the clearer it becomes to me that for all Kabbalists, certainly from the Middle Ages to now, who speak from within the Jewish tradition, and you can push me on that later if you want, because there's clearly a little bit of a fissure that we can explore. It seems pretty clear to me that the end goal of Kabbalah is to deepen one's personal faith and one's personal adherence to the mitzvot, which are the commandments in Judaism. And the idea is that the deeper one's understanding is of those mitzvot or commandments, the easier it is to see behind them to what the true divine purpose of them is. A danger may occur when people try to sever and disassociate the cognitive or psycho-spiritual or intellectual tradition itself from the performative quotidian aspects of Jewish faith and practice. And that's also something we can get into more deeply. But the short answer to your really depthful question is yes, I think there's a synergy between Buddhism and Kabbalah, Buddhism and Judaism, according to the terms that you used.
And is there what is the term used for the end goal of Kabbalah? Is there a term or a phrase that people are moving towards? How do you articulate that?
Great question. Not really. And I was going to resist telling any cheeky jokes, but I'll tell one that's not so cheeky. It's actually quite revealing about Judaism. There's an old saw that a Jewish person was stranded on an island, and when the rescue team finally arrived to rescue them, they couldn't help but notice the person had constructed a dwelling for themselves and two other buildings, and they both had the trappings of houses of worship and study. They had sacral vibes. And the rescuer said to the Jewish individual, "It seems like you've constructed an edifice for prayer and reflection, but do I see two of them?" And the Jewish refugee on the island says, "Yes, that's the one where I worship, and that's the other one where I would never set foot." So I tell the anecdote, and thank you for chuckling. I tell the anecdote to make a point, I think more serious, about how it's very hard to arrive at a single term that encapsulates even one aspect of the Jewish tradition. But I'm not going to dodge the question entirely. Ajahn Nisipo, of course not. One term that is invoked often by Jewish mystics, and that's an expression that I'll use, which is a rough approximation for Kabbalist, is truth. And that word in Hebrew is emet. And it contains three letters. And those three letters are the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet, the exact numerical middle letter of the Hebrew alphabet, and the final letter of the Hebrew alphabet. And so the notion encompassed in the very word itself is that it contains everything. And you'll hear me talk likely in the rest of the session about the Hebrew alphabet, which, like the Arabic alphabet, I should note here at the outset, has alphanumeric significance. What I mean by that is that Aleph in Hebrew is the equivalent to the digit, the integer one, just like Aleph, the first letter of the Arabic alphabet, is the equivalent to the letter one, and Bet in Hebrew is two, and Ba in Arabic is two, and so on down the line. So every word has both its semantic or plain meaning, we can call it, and it also has its numerological meaning, which can be used to point to a divine truth or to signal an analogy to another term in Hebrew or perhaps elsewhere in Jewish scriptures. So other terms may come to me, Ajahn Nisipo, as we continue to talk, but that's a big one, truth. And it can go in a lot of directions, even though it is a concise little three-letter word.
Yeah, and that word, it seems like maybe it has connotations similar to, or maybe exact, in line with the phrase from the Alpha to the Omega, basically the all. And just reading up a little bit about Kabbalah before this interview, was reading some interpretations that it's a non-dual practice, something which is inclining towards a vision of reality, which is non-dual, and perhaps even non-dual in its methods. Could you comment at all about that?
I'd be happy to. Ajahn Kobilo, not to turn it back on you, but would you mind another sentence or two about what you mean by non-dual?
Great question, because it's a complicated question. I think when I was reading about it in the Kabbalic sense, what I was reading is that basically God is imbued in everything. Maybe there's some essence of God in everything that exists. The Buddhist aspect of non-dualism that I'm most familiar with is a practice orientation where you actually come to a first person felt experience of the non-duality between subject and object, between interior and exterior, a felt sense of that. Mm-hmm. So not necessarily an ontological statement, but a felt sense and taking that almost as your meditation object.
Thank you so much for doing that, because I actually thought you were gesturing at something else with non-dual, so that's wonderfully clarifying. Let me start with the first part of your question about the Alpha and Omega, which allows me to make a historical point that I hope won't bore you guys or your audience. Alpha and Omega, of course, are Greek letters, and Greek was the most important language of high culture in Roman Palestine in the first century, when most level-headed people seem to agree that Kabbalah emerged. And so one of the things that fascinates me as both a historian of these ideas and also someone who lives in multiple worlds himself, or thinks of himself as living in multiple worlds, is it's an open question to me whether or not Kabbalah is exclusively or uniquely a Jewish system of thought, practice, and belief. I suspect, after years of study and having talked to people far more knowledgeable than I, that there is a tremendous amount of interchange between different traditions. In this instance, between the Hellenistic world of Roman antiquity on the one hand, and the indigenous Jewish minority in Roman Palestine in the first century. So that's just a little reflection about Alpha to Omega. So Ajahn Kobilo, as far as the non-duality of Kabbalah, absolutely. To a certain extent, the sense that there is a separation between sacred and profane, between God and humble human beings, even within God, him, her, themselves, and I use those pronouns not to be cheekily PC, but actually to try to explain the system of Sefirot, which I'll get to in a second. In all of those ways, the lack of a barrier between sacred profane, the lack of a barrier between God and humans, the lack of barriers between God and the rest of reality. Yes, Kabbalah is an intensely non-dual system. And I believe that one of the functions of that non-duality is to allow greater ease of intimacy in a spiritual sense. So if, and I don't mean to malign Catholicism at all when I say this, if a Catholic, when entering a cathedral, is made to feel submissive because of the grandeur and architectural statement of the cathedral, Judaism doesn't really do that. And Kabbalah specifically does not do that. It's not meant to make you feel submissive by invoking visual or architectural cues. And if, for example, a mystically inclined Jewish person, when they recite their prayers every day, thinks about hidden layers of meaning underneath the words of the prayer themselves, it allows them, according to Kabbalah, to access the divine source more directly and more efficiently. Since I mentioned sefirot, plural noun, singular sefirah, allow me, if I may, to briefly define that, because it's a cornerstone, thank you, it's a cornerstone concept. In Kabbalah, God is not necessarily singular. That is to say, God is unique, but God isn't one. And God is an amalgamation, a series of relationships that are described as the sefirot, which the best translation of that word I've ever heard is emanation, which is almost as vague as sefirah to my ears, but it is Neoplatonic, and it comes out of a world where Neoplatonism was a thriving doctrine in this part of the Roman Empire. And essentially, God contains 10 different characters, attributes, energetic currents, some of which are gendered male, some of which are gendered female. They all are in relationship with each other. Energy flows from the uppermost sefirah, which is called Keter, which means crown and sits above the symbolic head of God, all the way down to the lower ones. And so this notion that God is not necessarily singular, but rather a multiplicity of energetic forces, A, allows human beings to nuance their relationship to the divine. If, for example, one divine attribute is less responsive to a person in need or in joy, they could invoke another. And it also signals, this is another really important doctrine in Kabbalah, that God, him, her, themself, is responsive to human actions. So according to the most traditional Kabbalistic axiom that I don't think any rabbi or scholar would disagree with me for saying, human good deeds, the performance of the mitzvot, actually has a positive ameliorative effect on God. Similarly, human misdeeds or violations of mitzvot can physically and spiritually damage God, which is why Kabbalistic practitioners take the mitzvot and take a traditional life of religious observance so very seriously.
Yeah, I read a little bit about these sefirot, and they're very fascinating. One of them in particular was a word I'd come across before in learning different traditions, translations of what is translated in English from the Pali Sanskrit of metta or maitri. In English, it's usually loving kindness, a word which has, the English word has biblical, it comes from the King James edition. It occurs like 20 or 60 times in the Psalms, I believe. But This word chesed, I'm sure I'm mispronouncing it, but could you talk more about chesed and what it is? And you mentioned that some of these sefirot are located in the body, and where is chesed? And also all of these questions are inclined in the direction of practice. Like, how would one practice chesed? How would one practice the sefirot as well?
Every question you guys ask is both appropriate and spot on. And Ajahn Kovilo, your pronunciation of chesed was literally perfect. You got the consonant. That was awesome. And I'm smiling so much because I'm so glad you invoked this Pali, this Sanskrit Pali term that comes into English as loving kindness. Because not 2 months ago, I was sitting talking with two really brilliant colleagues of mine at the University of South Carolina, both religious studies scholars, Aaron Roberts and Noah Gardner. Shout out to the two of them if they ever hear this. And we were talking about this very phrase. And when I mentioned that chesed is translated as loving kindness, especially in the second half of the 20th century, Noah in particular smiled and said, I would bet that the Jewish translators who advanced that agenda were steeped in Buddhism. And I said, oh, really? How's that? And he said, because loving kindness is a classic English translation of this Sanskrit Pali term that you invoked. So that's just why I'm grinning. And as you can probably tell, I'm going to disagree with that translation of chesed. It's a very difficult term to translate. And my beloved and dear mentor and rabbi and teacher in all things rabbinics, Saul Cohen, with whom I've studied now for 14 years, at least once a week, sometimes more. He's a brilliant man. And I owe to him basically my entire advanced Jewish education. He thinks of chesed as a code of conduct. And that sounds very bellicose or harsh or drained of all psycho-emotional touchy-feely energy. But what he means by it is this, that if you look at its earliest occurrences in the Bible, it comes in Genesis when Abraham and Lot and Elimelech are negotiating things. They're negotiating how to divide land. Abraham is buying a grave for his wife Sarah after she dies. And he says to various people, if you treat me with chesed, I will treat you with chesed. And my beloved teacher, Rabbi Dr. Saul Cohen, has a whole article where he talks about this as a code of conduct. Essentially, you do right by me, I will do right by you. Now, moving into the Sefirot, Ajahn Kovilo, as you wisely nudged me to do, chesed is the shoulder, and it's the shoulder closest to the side of God's heart, symbolically, of course. And it is juxtaposed on his right side by the Sefirah of Gevurah, G-E-V-U-R-A-H, which is also called Midat HaDin, which literally means the attribute of judgment. So basically in Judaism, and here's a sort of a point about duality that Ajahn Kovilo I thought was what you might have meant earlier. In Judaism, there's often the notion of a continuous struggle between these two aspects of God, that he both wants to judge people according to the strict letter of the law, say for making a mistake or doing some misdeed, and he also wants to honor this covenantal code of conduct, or if you like, following the Sanskrit into English term, loving kindness. At the end of the day, Kabbalists and so-called rationalists agree chesed, this notion of covenantal fidelity or loving kindness, if you like, wins out. But God still does sit on the so-called throne of judgment, watching, assessing, thinking about whether or not it is appropriate to be harsh or lenient. And I suppose that is a duality built into Judaism. But let me close one more time by reminding your listeners that in any expression of Jewish theology grounded in the original texts, love wins in the end.
Thank you, Andrew. That's really, really interesting, the duality between those two qualities. And I just want to, before going to audience questions, maybe ground some of this discussion. It would be very helpful to get a very concrete picture of like what would someone practicing Kabbalah in their life, just what would that look like? I'm struck by the similarities between what we in Buddhism would call vinaya, which is how we act day to day, the rules by which we navigate. And what was the term again in Kabbalah for the rules?
Oh, the mitzvot.
The mitzvot, yes. And that leading or allowing one to access the Dhamma, which is the sort of higher wisdom. And so, you know, a Buddhist life might include holding to the five precepts as the Buddhist mitzvot, and these acts of loving kindness, of generosity, daily meditation, all aimed towards purifying the heart and letting go of greed, hatred, and delusion. And I love the language of these good acts being ameliorative towards God. I think that's such a beautiful image. But can you just ground us, like, what would a sincere practitioner of Kabbalah what would their daily life look like in terms of this practice? I don't want to go so far as to say, what does your practice of this look like? But can you just really ground this for us in a day-to-day existence?
I'll try. If I could do it easily, I'd probably be more enlightened than I am. I'll open with an anecdote. In 2015, so I was not a young man. I was in my mid-30s 10 years ago. I went to Israel to work as a shepherd and goat herd. And I was, not surprisingly, in a rural place. And my first host was a man who considered himself a Kabbalist and was. He dressed only in white clothing. He wore robes a lot. He prayed with fervent intensity. And one day early in my sojourn there, I asked him if he went to synagogue. And he got a little bit uncomfortable. And I apologized in case I had offended him with this inappropriate question. And he said, no, you didn't do anything wrong. It's just, I cannot really go to synagogue because I don't feel that anyone there prays with the appropriate devotion. And the word devotion, the word for devotion that he used was kavana, which is another key Kabbalistic concept that in modern Hebrew means intention or purpose or even direction. But in mystical doctrine is, as you can imagine, much more significant and much more freighted with theological meaning. To wit, to pray with kavana means at every single moment to focus on the fact that the words coming out of your heart and through your mouth and across your lips are speaking directly to the divine. So I'll open, and that's why this man, this blessed soul, couldn't really go to synagogue because everybody's rushing and mumbling through their prayers, like thinking about all the things they have to do. And to their credit, they are trying to contain the worshipful service to a dimension of time that people will not be turned off by. And I mean, Clear Mountain, just to put a plug for what you guys are doing, has had exponential growth, not to fetishize numbers, because I sort of hate that. But I think you have shown, and Mata, my wife, who's also a good friend of Ajahn Nisipo, has told me even more about this, that you guys are growing and thriving in the most organic ways imaginable. And to do that, I'm sure the two of you, Ajahn Kobilo and Ajahn Nisipo, you have to sort of keep things within relatively confined containers, lest people get lost and turned away. So what it looks like, in short, is that every religious devotion one performs, if you're a man, you would put on tefillin or phylacteries on your arm and on your forehead in the morning and recite prayers, and that's just some of the very first things a devout Jewish man does during the day. Every single act must be understood as a gesture toward the unification of God himself. And I've already spoken to the fact that God is divided into these 10 sefirot, some of which are getting along nicely, others of which are at tension, some of which have sort of sexual energy between them that is symbolically consummated, for example, on the Jewish Sabbath. And I can talk more about that if that's of interest later. I don't want to say too much now. So one quick answer, or not so quick, but one honest answer, Ajahn Nisipo, is the performance of every religious rite ought to be done with an awareness of the multiple layers of sacrality and significance inherent in that rite. More generally, I would say, a Kabbalist would need to walk through the world very sensitive to violation or harm to God's creation. I'm just looking outside of this beautiful setting where I find myself in Northern California. So for example, there is a Jewish precept not to waste unnecessarily. So some really serious Kabbalists forswear plastic utensils and plastic bags or single-use containers and have their own wooden forks and bowls and spoons and don't believe in bottled water. And that's a relatively trivial example, or maybe not, depending on where we stand on these things. But they would move through the world thinking that everything has an element of the divine in it, and to be wasteful of it is a direct offense to God. In short, if I may, being a Kabbalist in the everyday world is quite an onerous obligation, both in terms of what it requires of you day to day. And you guys are smiling, and Ajahn Kobilo, I just met you, but Ajahn Nisipo, I've spent some time with you, and I know how sincere and disciplined your practice is, and maybe those words don't resonate with you. But when I think about you rising early and alms taking and immersing in natural bodies of water and eating only once a day and all these things that are probably very obvious to your audience, but still relatively new to me, you know, you live a life of tremendous service and devotion and discipline. And that from a lay secular perspective, I have a tremendous admiration for it. And in some ways, the two of you are probably better positioned to understand what it means to be a Kabbalist in the daily world than I am, who has a more secular orientation to life.
Thank you for those kind words, and we'll try to live up to them. And I, you know, from seeing you interact with the world, Andrew, I've seen a similar attention, and just the care you take with each word you say is very admirable. And just to say thank you for that description, that articulation of looking towards caring for every moment and every action as a way of kind of honoring the divine within it is such a beautiful articulation of how one could move through the world and perhaps has resonance with mindfulness in a very meaningful way. So thank you.
So we'll go to questions, and people can still put other questions in the chat if you'd like. Our first question, did the Sephirot derive from the chakras?
Wow.
Did they develop independently? And just a little bit of background, having looked into this, into the chakras myself, I think they're not actually mentioned in classical Hindu, Vedic, Upanishadic, or later texts. They're somewhat of a new invention, maybe in the 1800s is when they were, or even later when they were together. But it does, would love to hear if you know of any research into the interaction between Kabbalah system and these other systems of India or even China. You've got the different, the chi meridians in these different points in the chakras of India. They're a very embodied system that I haven't encountered in other aspects or manifestations of Abrahamic religions.
This is, I mean, it's a really brilliant, thoughtful question. And Ajahn Kovilo, thank you for massaging it a little bit to allow me a wider opening into it. I'm going to dodge the question of did X come from Y or did they develop independently? Because the question of intellectual and spiritual genealogy is always very fraught, especially when we're dealing with great world traditions. And I don't use the adjective in a great in an empty way. I mean that as a very sincere appreciation for both of these traditions that have hundreds and hundreds, and actually in both cases, thousands of years of thought and practice and meditation behind them. I can, of course, say a couple of things. First, I'm not up to date on the research per se comparing these things. I can certainly say that in the last 50 years, there has been a tremendous interest on the part of Kabbalists in all manner of South Asian traditions. And I'm just casting as broad a net over Indic and Sanskrit, everything, which would include, of course, chakras. And some of that interest is unabashedly geared toward trying to lure ethnically Jewish young people, mostly who may have, quote unquote, strayed away from their Jewish tradition back into the fold by saying, oh, you're interested in Buddhism, you've read The Jew and the Lotus, you are already primed to think about the overlaps between these two traditions. Let's talk about how each of the Sephirot, which correspond to various body parts down the torso into the genitalia, and so forth, as resembling chakras. Now, what I would say, other than to point out in the last 50 years in the New Age movement, there's a lot of talk and discussion and thoughtful analysis of the overlaps. I would also say that all the way back to the Renaissance, which, if you guys can remember, Ajahn Nisipo's very flattering introduction, that is my home space intellectually and spiritually in some ways. Renaissance intellectuals were obsessed with syncretism. And they believed, in short, that all world traditions, the ones they knew about, they didn't know about all the ones that we know about. And I'm talking about the Renaissance in Western Europe, this sort of sliver, the far western end of the Eurasian continent, as it were. Christian Kabbalists, that is to say, Christian scholars and wise men and women, there were a few women, who appropriated, and I don't use that as a dirty word, I mean borrowed, absorbed, adapted, Kabbalistic traditions in order to prove the divinity of Christ and of Christianity, and that's what they were doing. Underneath that mission, that singular mission to prove the superiority of Christianity, also had an assumption that the way, for example, Kabbalah divides the Godhead into three, and there is an upper trinity, and I'm not saying it's Christian, but there are three upper sephirot, Keter, Chochmah, and Binah, might correspond to the Trinity in Catholicism. As you can probably tell from my tone and facial expressions, I think that's wrong. But the point is, this notion to find common ground between ancient, depthful world traditions is something that emerges in the Renaissance, the period that I study. I'll close by saying this about this very thoughtful question. When we think about chakras or sephirot, there is, to my mind, an acknowledgement that health is not a straightforward monolithic thing. There is no division in traditional Judaism, certainly not in Kabbalah, between mental health and physical health. And the entire tradition of Western medicine from Hippocrates in the 5th century BCE all the way through the scientific revolution, so-called, in the 17th century CE, acknowledges to a certain degree a multiplicity of factors that influence health and a number of ways in which our bodies, minds, and souls conspire together or fracture apart to encourage or inhibit health. So that's just my blanket way of saying that whether we're talking about chakras or chi or sephirot, in these traditions, it seems to me, there is a much more nuanced understanding of our complexity and how our very health is more complicated than blood pressure and LDL cholesterol counts and whatever scientific medicine prioritizes now.
Thank you, Andrew. On Saturday at Clear Mountain, someone asked if numbers in numbered Buddhist lists had meaning, which they don't. But in Kabbalah, numbers do have deeper meaning, correct? And we can pair that with a follow-up question. Is there a letter representing zero that is nothing?
Lovely. I'll start with the second one. Is there a letter representing zero, nothing? No, there is not. Aleph is the first letter. And it doesn't even make a sound in Hebrew. I find this fascinating. It's a glottal stop. So meaning it's the sound that you make when you open your mouth to start to say something, but don't actually say anything. And so Aleph always serves as a carrier for another vowel that rides on its back. I mean, both literally, it's depending on the vowel, the way it's positioned on the line, and symbolically. So nothing is a really complicated concept in Kabbalah because in order, I'll take you, for example, to 16th century Ottoman Safed, a city known as Tzfat today in modern Israel. It's in the Galilee. It's probably a place that Jesus of Nazareth visited during his lifetime. It has very intense spiritual vibes, even to people who don't think of themselves as spiritually attuned. It's high up on a hill. You can see the Sea of Galilee. You can sometimes see the Mediterranean. The light is incredible. And in the 16th century, a Sephardi Jewish mystic named Isaac Luria lived there, and his descendants had been exiled from Spain, where they had lived an illustriously accomplished spiritual, intellectual, cultural life for 1,500 years. And if you guys have heard that in 1492, not only did Columbus sail the ocean blue, but the Jews were tragically expelled from Spain, more specifically given the choice to convert to Catholicism en masse or leave. And Isaac Luria, this fellow in Ottoman Safed or modern day Tzfat, developed a concept, potentially in part to come to terms with the trauma of this expulsion, according to which God, in order to create the universe, had to contract himself. He had to make room for the world by constricting himself. And it has a term, this notion, it's tzimtzum, that maybe some of your listeners or readers have heard of. And this term is also tied to the notion of nothingness, because if God contracts himself to an infinitesimally small point, maybe that means that he's close to nothing. But he actually isn't nothing, because if he were nothing, he wouldn't exist. So it gets very philosophical. It gets to a level that I can't even really competently address because my poor little brain goes into a seizure. On to the first question about numerology. Whoever asked this question, absolutely. Every single Hebrew letter has a value numerically, and every Hebrew word has a numerical meaning. So one of the most popular ways this is invoked is as follows. It's a computational interpretive doctrine known as gematria, G-E-M-A-T-R-I-A. It's a Greek word, there's that borrowing again, that comes into Judaism sometime in late antiquity. And according to gematria, one of the ways of interpreting scripture or telling a joke, which I'll tell you in a minute, is that words which may seem totally dissimilar on their own, if you look at their underlying DNA, as it were, their numerology, they're actually the same thing. Okay, here's the joke. My second joke of the day. I'm not even a joke teller. You probably all know the Latin phrase in vino veritas, in wine there is truth. And I'm taking it that this is a pretty sober crowd, but it won't get any more risque than this. In vino veritas, in other words, if you want someone to tell you the truth, have them drink a little bit and they will. So in Kabbalistic exegesis and thought and humor, there is a even more vivid way of conveying this. Because in Judaism, in Hebrew, excuse me, the word wine, yain, and the word secret, sod, have the exact same numerical value. So there's this cute little saying, nichnas yain yatsa sod, literally. The wine enters, the secret exits. And so again, just one more time, in case people are a little confused, yain, this word for wine, has a numerical value of 70. The N sound is 50, and the ya sound is actually two tens put together. And sod is three letters that are 60, 4, and 6. So you see how both wine and secret equal 70, which is why they have this resonance.
Very cool. Yeah, we could definitely go way further down that. We'd love to hear more. Just something else I would love to hear more about. And we've only got a few minutes, but a really good question here. I would love to hear more qualities of the 10 Sephirot and how they may be used for understanding and practice.
Yeah, it's a big question, and I'll try to give two answers to it. I mean, three, really, because the first, my point before about chesed and gvura or midat ha-din, sort of love on the one hand, or the covenantal code versus judgment, is one of those ways that I think thinking about the Sephirot can be instructive in our daily lives. We all have moments. I mean, Ajahn Nisipo, when we were sort of flattering each other, I was gonna add that I've never heard you say an unkind word about anyone. And moreover, in all the hours we've spent together, I've never seen a sort of unkind thought flash across your face. And I don't mean this as empty flattery, it's very sincere. And the reason why I bring that up is because I think that we all, maybe not you two, but most of us have moments where we have unkind thoughts or judgments or statements about people, even sadly our spouses or best friends or children or elders. And I think that one of these ways of applying this doctrine of the Sephirot is to think that God himself, themselves, wrestles with this constant struggle between judgmental actions, thoughts, beliefs, and more open-minded, tolerant ones. So that's kind of answer number one. Answer number two, one of the most important pillars of Jewish practice is the Sabbath, which I think our dominant Christian society thinks of as Sunday, as the day that Jesus's followers made the Sabbath. In Judaism, it's Saturday, as I think most people know. And the first 3 days of the week correspond to three upper Sephirot, and the last 3 days of the week, so Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, correspond to three lower Sephirot. And on Friday evening, Jewish days start at sunset, which we can get into, but I don't want to digress too much. On Friday towards sunset, Jewish people around the world light two candles to symbolically inaugurate the Sabbath. And one of the things that some Kabbalistically inclined people do is try to imagine the energetic currents of Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, the first 3 days of the week, mingling with, reconciling with, coming into balance with Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and marrying in a certain way. I mentioned the sexuality of the Sefirot, and I promise this will stay G-rated. It's not erotic in any kind of pop cultural sense. It has to do with intercourse in the spiritual, symbolic way, that the first 3 days of the week all have a form of intercourse with the second 3 days of the week wed, and the offspring they produce is the Sabbath day, a taste of the world to come. Finally, I said three answers. So one was the two shoulders. Two was the symbolic marriage of the days of the week resulting in the Sabbath. And third and finally, each of the Sefirot is associated with a biblical patriarch or matriarch. So for example, one of the most significant, they're all significant, all these Sefirot, but one of the most precious is Tiferet, a word that in modern Hebrew means something like hope. Tiferet is associated with a biblical character, Jacob. So if, and all, again, all of the Sefirot are associated with matriarchs and patriarchs. So if you know anything about Jacob and his story in Egypt and his attributes and his marriage and his children, again, I don't want to spend too much time talking about it. One way of thinking about that Sefirah, which is found in our sort of pubic area, is to think about that character. And this might be too esoteric for some of you, but I hope that for others who have a certain awareness of Sarah, Rebecca, and Leah, for example, the three key matriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, three other key patriarchs. If you look up, not while I'm talking, or maybe while I'm talking if you like, if you look up the correspondences, it might make you curious about specific Sefirot vis-a-vis these personages.
Thank you, Professor Burns, Andrew. This is just a fascinating glimpse into a tradition that's far too deep for a 45-minute live stream. And yet some of the just parallels and resonances really, really are meaningful. And hopefully we can continue to discuss them. Andrew will be joining us on the Zoom session, which we usually follow these live streams with. I'll post the link into the chat from 6:45 to 7:30. And those who don't see it there are welcome to join on clearmountainmonastery.org. If you scroll down, you'll see the Wednesday evening Zoom session there and the link. Before we just say goodbye, Andrew, is there one term or phrase for this concept of bringing God to wholeness or healing God or like the term for that intention or action that you could leave us with? And if there's not, then I'm sorry, maybe there's something similar to it.
Yeah, absolutely, Ajahn Nisipo. And before I tell people that, I want to just really quickly say that I wasn't looking at the questions while we were having this conversation. I'm just, as a professor, I don't want any student to ever leave my class thinking I ignored them. So I was just looking at Ajahn Kovilo and Ajahn Nisipo the whole time. So I wasn't ignoring any questions in the chat. I just want your audience to know that. This isn't exactly what you asked, but it's close enough to make it responsible. And I think whatever it lacks in accuracy, it makes up for in sincerity. When we think about prayer in the sort of Christian-dominated world, we tend to think about petitionary prayer. That is to say, God, please do this or that for me. In Judaism, prayer is actually a reflexive verb. And I don't want to get too wonky in linguistics, but I hope most people know what a reflexive verb is. In Hebrew, it's lehitpalel. And one of the ways to translate it would be to stand in judgment or an examination of oneself. And when I pray, that's basically the mechanism that I try to operate by. I'm not asking God to do this favor for me or help this other person. Those thoughts might come into my mind, but really what I'm doing mostly is trying to center myself and ask, am I being true to who I am? Is the chesed side winning over the gevura side? Again, that sort of covenantal code of conduct / loving kindness side, or the more judgmental, angry, short-tempered, irascible side. So if we think about prayer in Judaism, lehit palel, the noun is tefillah, same root, less as give me, give me, give me, and more as how can I be better? How can I be more like myself? Maybe there's a resonance there, Ajahn Nisipo, with your tradition.
That was beautiful. Lehit palel.
Perfect. Nailed really? It. Yep, okay. Lehit palel.
Well, Andrew, thank you so much. And we'll see you on Zoom soon, but we just are so grateful for you joining us tonight.
So happy to be here. Thank you very much.